Shakespeare's Language and Art, Part 2 of 2. Section: Shakespeare's Blank Verse and Prosody Basics. Meter. What is blank verse? It's Shakespeare's go-to pattern or meter for conveying dramatic dialogue, and it makes up the great majority of his play's content. This pattern is made up of a series of unstressed and stressed syllables, divided into five distinct but interlocking units. Iambic pentameter is the technical term for blank verse. Iambic pentameter lines will contain five units called feet, with each consisting of an unstressed syllable followed by a stressed syllable. This unit is called an iamb, I-A-M-B, or iambus. So a regular iambic foot consists of a pair of syllables, the first one unaccented and the second accented. A regular line of iambic pentameter sounds like this: de-dum, 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 de-dum. The beat. All English verse is rather like music in the sense that it has a beat. The beat of blank verse is in keeping with the strongly accentual quality of ordinary English. The basic beat will run, as demonstrated above, de-dum, 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 de-dum. As with music, you can tap your foot to such a regular, strong beat. So, the beat is the constant, steady pulse of the verse line. Remember these lines from the song Rock and Roll Music by Chuck Berry. Quote unquote, "It's got a backbeat, you can't lose it." Rhythm. The rhythm of a line of poetry refers to the movement of sounds flowing across the basic pattern. The rhythm is established by the pattern of stressed and unstressed syllables as we move from one foot to the next through to the end of the metrical line. It may be easiest to talk about rhythm if we suggest that a long series of perfectly metrical iambic pentameter lines, pronounced in sing-song fashion, would soon become tiresome. We would only be bringing to audibility the bare-bones taxonomic pattern of the meter itself. No one likes monotony. To think of rhythm is to think of a certain complexity, a certain sophistication of the notes, so-called, that play across a basic, unvariegated framework. What is a poet's concern with metrical patterns and rhythms? Poets want to convey a certain meaning with a certain tone or attitude, so they will, of necessity, vary the stresses in ways that best allow this to happen. Most verse lines generate a rhythm that differs strategically from the bare sing-song metrical pattern, thus adding variety. The underlying beat will stay the same. It's what we keep coming home to, the backbeat. The basic metrical pattern, iambic pentameter, will be there in the background to guide us. But the rhythm may shift to suit the poet's purpose, thereby adding variety and priming our attention. That seems like an adequate way to understand the interplay between meter, beat, and rhythm. How can we describe the variations used by the poet? Poetics offers several rearrangements of stress within a given foot. Aside from the iam itself, didum, which is the most common unit, the most common substitutions are the anapest, spelled A-N-A-P-E-S-T, and the troche, spelled T-R-O-C-H-E-E, with occasional use of the dactyl, spelled D-A-C-T-Y-L, adjective dactylic, spondee, S-P-O-N-D-E-E, adjective spondaic, and the pyrrhic foot. So I'll go over each of these in turn. Anapest, dididum. A very common variation for an iamb. Troche, stressed, unstressed, dumdi. A fairly common variation. Dactyl, stressed, unstressed, unstressed, dumdidi. Epic or heroic verse is in dactylic hexameter. Six lines of dactylics. The spondee, two stressed syllables in a row, common in classical verse, occasional in modern. The pyrrhic foot, two unstressed. Didi, common in classical verse, occasional in modern verse. A number of benefits flow from using iambic pentameter blank verse. The first is that any kind of iambic pattern sounds close to everyday speech. If you listen for an iambic flow in English conversations, you'll often hear it. How about, "Today I drove to the store to buy some food." That's iambic. It's even pentameter. There's an anapestic substitution in the third foot, "to the store." But it's fairly regular iambic pentameter. Aside from the everyday quality of blank verse, there's also a sense of freedom from the demands of rhyming. Milton, who didn't care to be always hemmed in by rhyme schemes, says it best in his preface to Paradise Lost. The measure is English heroic verse without rhyme, as that of Homer in Greek and Virgil in Latin, rhyme being no necessary adjunct or true ornament of poem or good verse, in longer works especially, but the invention of a barbarous age to set off wretched matter and lame meter, graced indeed since by the use of some famous modern poets, carried away by custom, but much to their own vexation, hindrance and constraint to express many things otherwise, and for the most part worse than else they would have expressed them. Well, that's Milton for you. A third benefit associated with blank verse is that it can free up the poet to adopt a searching or questioning tone. Neoclassical rhyming heroic couplets are very fine, but there's a certain declamatory attitude, a self-certitude to them. A few of Alexander Pope's excellent heroic couplets from his Essay on Criticism will make the point. "True wit is nature to advantage dressed, what oft was thought but ne'er so well expressed. Something whose truth convinced at sight we find, that gives us back the image of our mind." Constraining oneself to this verse pattern, one would be hard-pressed to convey any tone other than, "Listen up, a timeless truth is being propounded." But that kind of certitude isn't usually what Shakespeare means to convey. Most often, plain, supple, blank verse suits him best. To be fair, there are various rhyme schemes, the Petrarchan sonnet, the English sonnet, the Spenserian stanza, and others, that do allow a poet to strike up various moods. It's just that for conveying dramatic action, blank verse functions as a blank slate. Dramatists can do whatever they like with it, and that's what they like about it. But to move on from the above definitions and justifications, how should we proceed with the marking up of a verse passage for an actor's practical performance? Below is a typical blank verse passage in a Shakespeare play, Julius Caesar. The lines are spoken in Act 1, Scene 1 by the angry tribune, Marellus, who is determined to give the common people of Rome a piece of his mind for, quote-unquote, making holiday to see Caesar. Let's start by scanning the passage merely to show the bare accentual pattern. All we want to do is show that this is, indeed, iambic pentameter, and to see if, when we read it out in that basic pattern, any of the accents fall on words in an unnatural way. So here's the passage. I'll read it one more time. "You blocks, you stones, you worse than senseless things. Oh, you hard hearts, you cruel men of Rome. Knew you not Pompey? Many a time and oft have you climbed up to walls and battlements, to towers and windows, yea, to chimney tops, your infants in your arms, and there have sat the livelong day with patient expectation to see great Pompey pass the streets of Rome." You can tell that I'm deliberately reading it sing-song. It seems as if the pattern leads to all the words being pronounced with their accents, just as we would say them in everyday non-poetical use. In other words, the verse pattern isn't making us mispronounce any of the words just to suit the metrical pattern. In the strictest metrical sense, then, this is very regular blank verse. But, of course, we aren't going to read the lines this way in actual performance. Pronouncing the lines as strictly iambic might honor the backbeat, the pattern, but it would overwhelm any nuanced sense we may hope to draw from the passage, leaving us with a comical sing-song recitation that would make the audience laugh at us. not the desired effect. How then shall we play the music off of the backbeat of strict iambic pentameter? Let's read the passage for its meaning, its sense, its feeling, and attitude, and then see how it looks or sounds when scanned for practical performance. We know that Marellus is angry with the plebeians for deserting their workday to celebrate Caesar. It helps to know that Marellus clearly prefers Pompey, Caesar's murdered rival, over the current great man. The tribune of the people, Marellus, is aggrieved at how easily these commoners have forgotten Pompey, whom they once adored as they now fawn upon Caesar. Let's speak the passage with that information in mind. Here's one possible scanning result. You blocks, you stones, you worse than senseless things. Oh, you hard hearts, you cruel men of Rome. Knew you not Pompey? Many a time and oft have you climbed up to walls and battlements, to towers and windows, yea, to chimney tops, your infants in your arms, and there have sat the livelong day with patient expectation to see great Pompey pass the streets of Rome. There are a relatively small number of changes from the bare-bones pattern, but they make a difference. For example, in the second line, oh, you hard hearts, oh, you hard hearts, and you is unaccented, making a trochee, while hard hearts has been changed to a spondee, hard hearts. In practice, hearts would probably be pronounced with somewhat more emphasis than hard. The most accurate way to describe this unit would perhaps be semi-spondaic. How's that for a fancy term? The foot, knew you, is accented as a trochee, that is, one stressed and then one unstressed. Trochee, knew you, with strong emphasis to indicate Marellus's angry, condescending tone towards the wayward plebeians. In the fourth line, have you would probably be pronounced in a very light, almost unstressed manner, and then climbed up would be pronounced as a trochee. Climbed up. In a few of the lines, the final foot is basically unstressed, i.e. treated as a Pyrrhic unit. Two unstressed syllables, that is. Opinions may vary, but this seems like a reasonable estimation of how to pronounce the above lines in keeping with the desired feeling and tone. Along with pregnant pauses, gestures, and other things in a trained actor's bag of tricks, such a reading captures the meaning and the feeling that we would like to draw from the passage. The audience, we hope, will understand from this opening passage that Caesar's ascendancy has made him not only a lot of fair-weather, holiday-loving friends, but also serious enemies, men who do not mean him well. Incidentally, there's another obvious way that an actor's reading will affect the basic metrical pattern. Actors will almost certainly respect a given line's internal punctuation, commas, periods, dash, exclamation points, which may indicate that a thought has come to an end or taken a sudden turn, and so forth. The passage from Julius Caesar that we are working with is actually pretty smooth, but just to give an example, the words, knew you not Pompey, might occasion a short pause afterwards, giving the actor a chance to express his feeling of exasperation with the common folk's behavior. In some cases, however, a verse line may be split between two characters and so break off right in the middle. This kind of split line might call for a somewhat longer pause. An example from Julius Caesar. Brutus says, "What means this shouting? I do fear the people choose Caesar for their king." And Cassius says, "Aye, do you fear it?" Brutus and Cassius share line 80, which, if strung together, would be, "Choose Caesar for their king. Aye, do you fear it?" In this case, the scansion for basic patterning seems to run, "Choose Caesar for their king. Aye, do you fear it?" But, clearly, in the more nuanced, performance-oriented scansion, this line will undergo some changes and its practical stress patterning. Perhaps the last 2 feet could run, "I do you fear it." That makes for a trochee and an amphibrach, or I am with a feminine ending. In sum, what have we learned from this guide? Well, A good deal of pedantic pettifogging ink has been spilled over the centuries about scansion and prosody, along with some brilliant commentary on poetics in the broadest sense. But as readers who just want to get the most out of our experience studying Shakespeare and other Elizabethan Jacobean playwrights, all we really need to do is read dramatic verse for its sense, including whatever we can gather from the immediate context of the lines in question regarding feeling, attitude, tone, purpose, and so forth. We will use our knowledge of the words in the text, of human nature, and so forth, and our common sense. And if we do that, we will get the accents right almost every time. The iambic pentameter or some other pattern will give us our starting point, and we'll take things from there. Remember, too, the importance in Shakespeare of antithesis, which we can define as setting the word against the word, in a way that ensures the memorable quality of the speech. An ear for antithesis is vital to any good reader of Shakespearean verse. Finally, let's have a quick look at a form that Shakespeare uses in addition to blank verse in his plays. He often casts characters' dialogue in prose form. Sometimes he does this to suit the characters. They may be working class, for example, or some less than elegantly poetical situation. But in truth, there's no neat rule for when Shakespeare uses prose. Still, prose is more conversational and less formal. It seems like language that is stepping back from the somewhat elevated status we give it when we classify it as poetry. Below is a passage spoken by Leontes' counselor Camillo in The Winter's Tale. When you scan it, you'll easily discern that it does not fit into a regular pattern. Let's use the Folger Shakespeare Library's online copy, slightly edited but respecting the line breaks as given to suit the original folio editor's needs. Cecilia cannot show himself overkind to Bohemia. They were trained together in their childhoods, and there rooted betwixt them then such an affection which cannot choose but branch now. The very first line has 16 or 17 syllables, depending on how we pronounce Cecilia, and we can't scan the line as iambic without having to wrench words from their ordinary accentual pattern. The second line would work as trochaic pentameter, but that's the reverse of iambic. This is more or less plain, ordinary speech, not poetry per se. And to convey the basic information that Camillo has to offer, Shakespeare evidently thought prose would be the most appropriate choice. Prose, then, is another form to be aware of as we read Shakespeare's plays. Textual scholars have pointed out that he tends to be comfortable using more of it in his later plays, but he uses it in the earlier plays as well. Thanks for listening. This audio lecture was recorded on Wednesday, September 24th, 2025. The foregoing material is copyright 2024, revised 2025 by Alfred J. Drake. For Shakespeare quotations, I have relied on the Norton Shakespeare 3rd edition, 4-volume, genre-based format.